Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
What is your job, Trump? It is to reset the world order through tariffs, move us to multipolarity, pump as much money into the stock market, and we'll hedge our bets. The economy doesn't matter. The stock market does.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Ladies and gentlemen, as always today, we're going to start with the big picture. We're going to dial all the way out and then move back into the center. And today, we're talking with a true visionary who is charting an escape route via Bitcoin and decentralized finance. Today's guest is Simon Dixon. I've been looking forward to this podcast for a very long time. He is the CEO and co-founder of Bank to the Future, revolutionary investment platform that's funneled an enormous amount of capital into fintech and crypto ventures since 2011. That puts it in context. He is the author of the groundbreaking 2012 book, Bank to the Future, the very first to champion Bitcoin as a bulwark against fiscal meltdowns. And he's an ex-banker, has launched Bitcoin capital funds, rallied millions through crowdfunding for cutting-edge firms, emerged as a leading crusader against the rigged legacy system. You know I'm all about that. And Simon is going to connect some big dots for us today, help explain his proof of weapons network concept, all so we can begin to figure out how the world actually works, which enables us, hopefully, to make better decisions with our own lives. Welcome to Finance U. I'm your host, Chris Martinson. Simon, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Yeah, real pleasure. So to begin, your background, I mean, most of my audience will know you from Twitter or Bitcoin circles, but many might be new to you as well. Can you, a two-minute version, you know, why did a successful London investment banker walk away in 2006, predict the 2008 crisis, become one of the earliest Bitcoin advocates? Tell us, take us through that arc if you could.
Yeah, sure. I guess my journey in finance began 25 years ago. My father lost all of his money in the dot-com boom and bust. So, you know, he went from taking his entire life to make £1 million to losing it all in the dot-com boom and bust. And he didn't ever understand what happened to his money. So he asked me one day, son, I don't know where that money went. Who ended up with that money? And I got obsessed with that question. So kind of went down the conventional route, like studied economics, you know, did financial qualifications to try and find out how to give financial advisory work. And then, you know, ended up as a T-boy at a stockbroker, and then got myself you know, into the City of London, started as a market maker on the London Stock Exchange, and then really wanted to understand a bit more about the business side. So my last corporate job was in corporate finance. And on the side, I was just really studying monetary reform, read, you know, books on how money really works, and realized that I'm just a cog in a wheel, but no one really fully understands the whole system. And so I decided that I would throw in the corporate towel in 2006 and set about giving lectures on monetary reform. Once I realized what the banking system, you know, how it actually works, decided that I'd attempt to create a non-fractional reserve bank to kind of demonstrate how a sustainable bank might work. Hit many, many challenges and realized that it wasn't actually possible. If you want to engage in banking, you have to create digital currency every time you issue a loan. And if you wanted to do full reserves, you have to build it on top of somebody else's bank. So you do full reserve, but they do fractional reserves. And so, you know, after failing at trying to create a bank, ended up being invited to the first Bitcoin conference, which was in Prague, when Bitcoin had crashed from $30 to $3. Realized that the only way to build outside the system was to actually build on top of an alternative currency. So at that moment, invested in Bitcoin at $3 and started, when Bitcoin did really well, I started supporting other companies that couldn't raise finance and ended up investing in about 100 different companies that became multi-billion dollar unicorns now, like Coinbase, Kraken, Circle, Bitstamp, Bitfinex, and many others. And just been on a 15-year journey of seeing Bitcoin come from an activist movement of us versus the banks with a few crazy people in the room to actually a $2.3 trillion market cap with the largest financial institutions in the world deciding that they need to embrace this sector. And so now I'm kind of at the stage where I'm trying to educate people. You know, Bitcoin treated me very well, so I just spend my time educating people on the original mission of what we set out to achieve, because now Wall Street wants to control Bitcoin as much as possible. So trying to help people understand how to be sovereign outside the system and recognize some of the future trends now that we're moving to this world of Bitcoin, artificial intelligence, central bank digital currencies, and, you know, an Orwellian programmable nightmare. So that's my journey, and it brings me to where we are now.
Fantastic summary. By the way, very similar journeys for us, except I didn't get into Bitcoin when I probably should have, obviously. So, but it was I was working in corporate finance for a while. Then I was a consultant. And then, you know, I lost all this. I didn't lose £1 million, but I got a big haircut in the dot-com bust. So it got me curious, and I started looking around, and I remember clearly what happened to me. It was 2004. I read Creature from Jekyll Island, and I said, whoa, hold up. I've got a PhD. I've got an MBA. Nobody ever taught me that. Like, is this how money is made? So I had to go out and prove it wrong, and of course, it's all right. The banking system just makes money out of thin air, and it hop, skip, and a jump, and it led me to conclude that, oh, this is a really elegant form of slavery when you look at it in a certain way, where somebody controls your life force with very little energy expended on their side, right, for the effort. Maybe that's a skip too far for a lot of folks, but you spend enough time in there, you go, hey, wait a minute. This is a scam, isn't it?
Well, not only is it a scam, but it's a very well-crafted and engineered Ponzi scheme. You know, every single fiat currency is created as a credit by a bank. You know, the bank creates money every time they issue a loan, and then they charge interest on that loan. Now, when you go out into, put it right back down into, if you create $1,000 by issuing a loan, somebody has to pay a 10% interest and repay $1,100. Where is the $100? Well, it needs to be created into existence by somebody else borrowing it. And so you end up, if you look at the British Empire, you know, you started when the Bank of England was around. We need some money for war. The Bank of England was created, an elaborate accounting scheme that allowed for this double entry bookkeeping was created in order to get the government into debt. So the Bank of England got to create the pound. The government got to borrow it. They got the war machine. And then right up until, you know, the First World War, the British government were bankrupted. So, you know, the experiment was repeated again with a couple of central banks in America. Then finally they got the Federal Reserve. And now the Federal Reserve has taken the American government via a military industrial complex from virtually no debt to $38 trillion. And that's by design. You know, the central banking system is the privatization of a fiat currency, where there's not enough interest to repay the debt. And so therefore, the only thing that keeps the engine alive is refinancing the debt, whether that's an individual, a corporate debt. And then you get crony capitalism to get the cheap rates while the average person pays payday loans and credit cards, 30, 40% interest. And the corporate that has access can get 0% through quantitative easing or whatever it may be. And obviously get the government into debt and then use the global finance system to get every government into debt. Until they keep buying the last treasury, until no one will buy a treasury, and then the system just goes and repeats itself in the next world order.
Well, this is brilliant. So I want to, this is cutting to the chase of a lot of my life's work as well, which is this idea that, let me leave aside the moral dimension of how I think of fiat money. It has a math problem baked into it, which is in that interest component you mentioned, that little hitch step. It's just a feature of the system, not a bug, a feature. It's going to constantly be growing exponentially, right? Because we're compounding interest on top of interest. And if it doesn't get more credit in enough to satisfy the prior interest, the whole thing goes kaput. So since 1971, when we abandoned the gold standard, we've been compounding our debts in the United States, not just federal, but across the whole system, at about 9% a year. And our economy is growing at 3% a year. We have a math problem. We are, the claims, all that debt is now spiking and it's piling up. And I think this is not wonky. This is perfect setup for understanding why I think we're going to a new system of world control or organization. Because this old model, you don't have to be a math genius. It's got a math flaw and it's going to break sooner or later.
Yeah, you got it exactly right. Those are the key things. If you take the growth rate and you take the average interest rate, and as long as that growth rate is outperforming that average interest rate, and you can keep the Ponzi going. But when the average interest rate is above the growth rate, you have a problem. And so now we've hit a stage where we're at the end of what I consider to be the U.S. debt cycle. And because the economy is so K-shaped, the term comes, where the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, there are those that have access are on the right side of the debt. It's their asset. And they're those where they are the assets because they're in debt. You have this system now where people are so indebted that you've hit, wealth inequality is causing psychological issues, is causing suicide rates, is causing low birth rates because people can't afford, is causing mental issues, drug addictions, homelessness. Is causing extreme populism. Those that feel shafted by the system are going more and more extreme to the left and looking for the government to resolve their issue. And those that are benefiting from the system are hedging their bets, leaving and deciding what they're going to do with their assets. So then eventually you end up with only the most unproductive, and you cannot outgrow, you cannot use any productivity in that type of environment to outpace the interest, at which point you get radical things being done with monetary policy. That's where I think we are right now.
So to get to this, then, I agree with all of that. And I think that we're a couple of smart guys, but there's a lot of smart people in the government. They know this. They must know this. They must know that the system has an expiry date upon it, and it's not that far in the future. It's not 100 years from now. It's somewhere out there. So I think this is important to understand because obviously they're not going to just sail into a giant, deflationary Ponzi scheme collapse without a plan. And I think the plan is all the stuff we're detecting. But let me dial back to that. Do you believe that we're the only two people out there who can see this? Or do you think there are people within the financial universe who see this too?
Absolutely. They know exactly what's happening. So this is inevitable, predictable, guaranteed. But it is hidden behind layers and layers and layers of complexity where many, many different institutions are cogs in the wheel. And I think it's really important. I think this is one thing that not many people see. You talked about a phrase that I coined called proof of weapons. It's a strange phrase.
But it comes from
Bitcoin because Bitcoin's backed by energy and they call it proof of work. So it's a decentralized supercomputer that powers the network that enforces its fixed supply and the ability for you to own your own money without a bank and send it, without government permission. So they came up with this phrase, Satoshi used this phrase or it hit him this phrase, proof of work. I describe fiat currency as proof of weapons. And the reason is because most people think of a government as too big and the ultimate power structure. I argue that the government is 100% subordinate to a private corporate structure. And it consists of several players. At the root of it is a central bank, but underneath the central bank are the shareholders. And in the case of the Federal Reserve, you've got the 12 regional banks, and underneath that, you have all the clearing banks. And so the Federal Reserve is owned by the private banks that get to create the dollar. And then through this, this ability to create the dollar, you have the ability to determine where capital gets allocated. And so banks' favorite asset is obviously a mortgage. They like to create money through a mortgage, which is why real estate prices always go up. Because as long as you can create money to issue a mortgage and you can further duration, which is what they're doing at the moment, then you get to create dollars and you receive interest on those dollars. And when there's a crisis, you can get the government to bail you out. How do you control the government? Well, you allocate lobby finance, and so the government is for sale. If you want to buy Congress, if you want to buy Senate, then there is a budget for every member of Senate and every member of Congress, and it's called lobby. And so the banking lobby is a large lobby, and you have all these different types of weapons of different sectors, but at the ultimate top of the structure, you have what I call, people are familiar with the word military-industrial complex. I call it a financial-industrial complex. You have the retail commercial banks that get to create a fiat currency every time they issue a loan in a debt-based Ponzi. Then they can go to the investment banks, which get to securitize, financialize, even now tokenize, but they get to turn the assets into products. They also have the ability to issue through the bond market, roll over the debt through purchasing bonds with money they create out of nothing. Then you have, at the top of that, you have the asset managers. And the asset managers basically created these different types of schemes where you would give all your pension money every month, all of your insurance premiums every month, all of your student loans through endowments, all of your credit card financing, and they would use the investment bank to structure them into mortgage-backed securities, you know, all these different types of products. Then you would have the ability to control and influence every stock. By taking all of these passive investments, people can't be bothered to find the complexity of how to invest in a few companies. So they invest in the S&P 500. That gives those that are managing these S&P 500 index funds a lot of power. And it's the asset managers that are getting all of these flows and passively investing them. So now you have the asset management industry. Now, when you use these investment banks, they also create tools to control prices. That's the derivatives market. Mm-hmm. And so by creating options, futures, and various other financial weapons of mass destruction, they have the ability to use that vast capital, utilize it via a network of hedge funds in the asset management industry, and do all sorts of elaborate things to manipulate prices. This is the financial industrial complex. Now, if you use those derivatives to send companies bankrupt, if you want, you can then acquire them on the cheap through the private equity industry. You then have a venture capital industry, which takes all the entrepreneurs and primes them for becoming public companies through the investment banks. And so through this very, you know, what quote unquote seems like a capitalist system, you've essentially created an entire financial industrial complex that allows for any company to be subordinate to that network. Because, you know, what you end up doing, you take a very successful company, for example, like Tesla, you know, if you want to control Elon Musk, you have the ability to pump all those passive index funds into Tesla by allowing them to get a credit rating and on the S&P included in the index. You also have some of the most successful money managers like BlackRock. They have technology like Aladdin, where basically all of the different money managers uses their data. And so by controlling those datas, you get to allocate capital flows with all of these different money managers. Now, the interesting thing is when you look at what technology do the Treasury use when they're allocating things like stimulus checks and quantity, you know, and various other checks? Well, they use BlackRock's technology. Then you look at what does the Federal Reserve use? Well, the Federal Reserve uses BlackRock's technology in much of their monetary policy. So now you've got an asset manager that has access to all the voting rights on all the shares. All of these different banks and institutions, the financial industrial complex, are all public companies. And so BlackRock, via your pension, gets a board seat on all the companies, gets passive flows to be the largest shareholder so they can influence vote. And via their network of investment banks, and they get to decide whether you get access to capital. And so if you comply with the network, you get access to capital, you get preferential treatment. So if Elon Musk decides to comply with the network, he can take his Tesla stock, borrow against it, and now Elon Musk is subordinate to the network. If they want to ruin his net worth, they can knock him off the network by using some derivatives to manipulate the share price, which should then knock them off the S&P 500 so they don't get access to index. They don't get access to the money printing because the fiscal policy and monetary policy is being managed via the same network. And you can essentially create a subordinate power structure. And so when you look at what are the most important companies, well, you have a military industrial complex, which is all the military companies. They're all public. They're all subordinate to the same structure. They get access to all the Pentagon budgets. So the government can print $1 trillion, allocate it to military companies. They have access to intelligence agencies, what we would call the deep state. And so they're subordinate to this structure as well, because, you know, you've got the ability to access these capital flows. What about all the big tech companies? You know, you'd think that NVIDIA is on top of the world right now, and Apple and Google and Palantir. Actually, they're all subordinate to the same structure because their share price to get access to all of this money printing capital flows is nothing to do with earnings per share or anything like that. It's access to Pentagon budgets. It's access to money printing. It's access to hiding information via press and media, which is also controlled by the same network. And so now you can actually even control the algorithms of, you know, TikTok, X, all of these different technical industrial complex. And so all this to say is, what is the proof of weapons network? Well, it weaponizes technology, finance, military, deep state intelligence, media, under a structure of a network that lobbies the government, controls treasury, and also provides the technology to Fed. And who are the Fed? Monetary policy. Who owns monetary policy? The banks. And so really what looks like capitalism is actually a privatized, unaccountable structure. And then it even goes a little bit deeper because we've started to see all these blackmail networks, you know, the Epsteins, the P. Diddy's. These, let's put them under the deep state. They're connected to intelligence. And so you can bribe judicial. And so Congress, Senate, judicial, monetary policy, fiscal policy, every single company, 20,000 companies, access to capital. You essentially are a power structure that you just utilize the government as a piggy bank. The government's job is to create $38 trillion of debt. And then eventually the dollar is no longer useful to this network. And so you can change capital flows into different countries, different currencies, and rebuild the financial industrial complex outside of the dollar system. And so that's what I think people need to understand, that governments are not in charge. Governments are subordinate. So when I look at Trump, I don't see Trump's tariff policy. I see BlackRock's tariff policy. I don't see negotiations between countries. I see countries negotiating with BlackRock's portfolio companies, you know, where NVIDIA is going to get a new contract. Today, as we record, MBS is visiting the White House. They're renegotiating the petrodollar. And who's on top of those negotiations? It's the financial industrial complex that's co-investing with the Gulf sovereign wealth. And Trump is an administrator to fulfill those negotiations. and then just put narrative on top. This is to make America great again. And sorry, I went very deep there, but that helps you understand this network that is mainly controlled by large financial players.
Today's markets are more volatile than ever. With ongoing economic and geopolitical uncertainty, navigating such environments requires thoughtful, adaptive strategies, not a one-size-fits-all approach. At Peak Financial Investing, our registered investment advisory firm connects clients with experienced wealth managers who focus on active portfolio management. These professionals use evidence-based strategies designed to respond to changing conditions, not outdated formulas, but customized approaches grounded in research, discipline, and risk awareness. We believe in open, informed conversations, including discussing tools like precious metals and diversification as part of a broader financial strategy. Every investor's situation is unique, and our advisors tailor their guidance accordingly. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com today to schedule your free consultation and explore how proactive management can support your financial goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, proud to work with Peak Financial Investing, and my support reflects my professional views. I encourage you to take control of your financial future by making informed decisions. So my question, let me get to this by way of example. So I believe that Charlie Munger was right. You show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome. Humans are incentive creatures. And so this money system is incentivized around making more of itself and consolidating control, because that gives you monopolistic sort of oversight on this thing, and you can really force things your way. The problem with that is that that money itself is just a medium of exchange. It has no strategy beyond more of itself, right? So fast forward. I've been a longtime silver investor, and I've watched them apply this network in this little tiny market. Silver's chump change, $38 billion total market cap. Like, it's this little thing. Doesn't matter. They come in and they wang it around with derivatives, and they abuse it, and they do all this stuff. And fast forward, here we are. 6 years in a row now, we've had structural deficits where we're not getting as much silver out as we're using, because price, supply, demand, it's a simple economic chart. Price is too low to create more supply, and demand is now about to move price. At any rate, point is that this system was optimizing for raping the silver market over and over again for money. But it wasn't looking for the longer term, saying, hey, is this the right thing to do? Is this serve our longer term interests? Or there could be, let's say, second order consequences to that. That is anybody in this system overseeing any of this? Or is this just one big sort of like Borg that people have plugged their money conger into, and it really doesn't have a driver?
Yeah, I'd say at the top of the power structure, people like to think it's like an organized cabal of and come up with conspiracy theories. I think it's less sophisticated than that. I think it's actually just reached this stage where the more assets you can manage, the more power you have in the network. And so, you know, if you, it's determined by private wealth, it's determined by institutional wealth management, is determined by asset management, and is determined by the ability to create the dollar and to create the stocks and bonds. And so you imagine a power struggle of, you've got a force at the bottom, which is the government. You know, people think they vote, you know, the network decides who the president is, and right. And they have full ability to do that. And if you go against that grain, you can either be, you know, knocked down with a weapon, you can either be bribed, blackmailed, or assassinated at the extreme. And they have the ability to do all of the above. And so there is no power structure that's taking on this system, because the system's too big. But who is at the very top of that structure? Well, it's just determined by assets under management, really. And it used to be private banking families. You know, way back in the day, you'd have very organized private wealth. For example, when the Federal Reserve was created, you know, the governor was one of the Warburgs. The Warburgs were also one of the brothers. One was a governor of the Federal Reserve. The other was a governor of the Rice Bank, and the Rice Bank was connected to later the Bank for International Settlements. and they funded, you know, the Nazi Germany. Through this network, Wall Street also funded the Bolshevik Revolution and the overthrow of the Russian Tsar and replaced it with the Soviet Union. So the same families originally were funding fake capitalism with the Federal Reserve, fascism with Nazi Germany, and communism and the through the Soviet Union. And so they hedge every position, and they would bet whichever ideology maintains is still the same finance houses. But over time, they became public. And so as they became public, they put everything for sale. And so right now, if, for example, you want to gain influence and control over the entire West, because it is now fully financialized, securitized, and you can buy politicians, all you need to do is get a stake in BlackRock. And so obviously me and you, Joe Schmo, we could invest in BlackRock. But if you end up with significant wealth, so maybe you're China, you've got a manufacturing base, you've got trillions of dollars of reserves, you're running a trade surplus. America's running a trade deficit. And the trade deficit country, the biggest export of America is the dollar, the debt. The dollar is debt. And so America needs to export the dollar, i.e. export debt. You create wars in order to do that. That's, you know, the covert operations. Whereas China's got a manufacturing base. America was built on a military industrial complex manufacturing base. But over time, it sold it. It financialized it, it securitized it. And so China ended up with the cheap labor and building that manufacturing base. So if you've got surplus and you've got sovereign wealth, which some countries do, some in Europe, like Norway, have it. You've got the Gulf countries, the Qataris, the Emiratis, the Saudis, and various others. And you've got China. So if you want to buy America and influence over America, you just buy BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard. Now, Vanguard's private. But if you look at the largest shareholder, and you think about this, the largest shareholder in BlackRock, it is actually the QAT Sovereign Wealth Fund. And so you can influence the entire geopolitics through buying BlackRock. Now, what is BlackRock? Originally, you could have thought of the military industrial complex was nationalistic. It was aligned with America. You know, there was an old phrase, what's good for General Motors is good for America. But these are now global institutions. And so when they're analyzing their spreadsheets, they're just looking at not nationalistic America first, European first, UK first. They're thinking about how do I maximize profits? How do I hedge? And how do I profit from any scenario? And so you can profit from creating a war, hedge if it goes wrong, profit from reconstruction contracts, build the financial weapons of mass destruction to subordinate countries. And this is what they do. Their goal is to turn everything into an asset and own the asset. And so you can influence wealth. And so that's why I believe we're moving to a multipolar world, because BlackRock is essentially co-investing with the Gulf states in every deal. And all the money from the Gulf states is coming from China's manufacturing, who's buying the oil off the Gulf states. So then if Saudi, for example, says, well, the last 60 years were about the petrodollar, but America's now competing with us, they're energy independent, they're an exporter of oil and gas. What are we going to do? Who's giving us all our money now? It's China. So China's our customer. And what are we going to do with our excess money? Well, we're going to buy America. We're going to buy OpenAI. We're going to buy BlackRock shares. We're going to buy all of the artificial intelligence. And then we're going to use our influence to be able to negotiate nuclear energy, data centers, artificial intelligence. And we want that in the Middle East. We'll be better at that. And so now the chessboard can be reset. We're no longer subordinate to America. It's going through decolonization process. The important customer is China. And so that's where we are today. And so the whole point here is that you kind of look at China defended against with capital controls and having never having a corporate structure that could go above the government. So they've protected themselves from that. But America is now controlled by that structure. And that structure is hosted in America with no America First agenda. So they don't care what happens to America as long as they have the capital markets. And so now you've got this divergence. The economy's going to shit. The stock market's doing really well. And the government is doing fiscal dominance. It's printing, 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 printing to prop up the stock market. And that really summarizes where we are. And the Trump administration has a job. What is your job, Trump? It is to reset the world order through tariffs, move us to multipolarity, pump as much money into the stock market, and we'll hedge our bets. The economy doesn't matter. The stock market does.
So then this is really a system of control. And so control is shifting. The baton, the multipolar world is a fancy way of saying, okay, it's not just United States anymore. I got a host of questions around that. The first would be, I sort of have the impression that maybe Putin was a little bit of a thorn in the side of that model for two reasons. First, when he took over, he kicked all the billionaires out, right? The oligarchs, we call them. Sorry, oligarchs. You have to use the correct, politically correct U.S. term. We have billionaires. They have oligarchs, right? So he kicked them out, and because he said, I think he saw it, got them to the table and said, we can play, do this easy way, hard way. I'd rather do it the easy way. They said, nah, we think we can crush you. They lost. And then I've heard recently, like the EU leadership, odious as it is, like Kallas saying, oh, it's our goal to sort of split Russia up into a bunch of states and, you know, basically harvest their resources. It feels to me like Putin's not playing their game, and that explains the deep hatred. Because it's not the hatred of actual people. It's what this network you're talking about has decided. This guy isn't, he's not doing how we want him to do it. So we're going to make people hate him. You know, that's kind of how it's felt to me.
I'd agree with that. And digging into that a little bit, the first thing to realize is that there is no such thing as media or reporting. There's only propaganda. And mm-hmm. so... whenever you read media, for example, if I read the Financial Times, I don't see an accurate assessment of reality. I say, this is what the proof of weapons, the financial industrial complex wants you to do with your money. And so through articles, they push out narratives, and then it goes through alternative media and traditional media, and then that reallocates capital flows. You know, if you're watching Al Jazeera, that's what Qatar wants you to believe. If you're reading Axios, that's what Israel wants you to believe. If you're watching Fox, you know, and CNN, that's what both sides of the uni party want you to believe through two different narratives. And so there is no such thing as journalism. There is just propaganda. And what we found out, for example, when Elon came in with the Department of Government Efficiency, there was a lot that AI revealed that probably wasn't meant to come out. I'm not sure whether it was, or maybe it strategically was meant to come out because maybe they're weakening the dollar. And what all I see right now is operations to make it where you don't want to invest in America anymore and weaken the dollar. You know, that's what everything's, you know, Trump is an agent of chaos, and I believe he works for the banks and the financial industrial complex. You know, you could see the USAID was funding into the BBC and Ukrainian media in order to push out a narrative. And the narrative was Putin is Hitler. Whether you like him or not, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying how things are. What did Putin do? You quite rightly articulated that we had the fall of the Soviet Union. We then had the neoliberal installation of Western central banks, Western debt markets, and those that were connected in the Soviet Union system became the oligarchs. Putin came along and said, no, we're going to nationalize our resources, make it where people don't have to pay as much tax by having a national oil. We'll still have our military industrial complex. But anyone that's trying to take our strategic resources and financialize them and put them into the West, you know, and those oligarchs that are facilitating that, he arrested them, chucked them out, and wouldn't allow for that agenda. He had a nationalistic identity. And so the media machine then says, right, you are Hitler, and let's make you Hitler. Now, what's interesting is that when I look at, you know, you obviously have, right, we are defending democracy. What does defending democracy mean?
Yeah.
It means you have a narrative that justifies the money that is being printed through the Federal Reserve to go back into the military industrial complex. Now, if you want the Bank of England to print money and the ECB to print money, then you use NATO. And so through the deep state, you have the military companies that need the money. They want you to print ECB. They want those euros to come back into the US stock market. And what is the benefit of this? Well, you can subordinate Europe to the proof of weapons network. So it's not America. It's America is the host country for the network. So the financial industrial complex uses the military industrial complex in order to agitate wars, uses its intelligence in order to overthrow government. So it installed, you know, did a colored revolution in Ukraine in 2014. Mm-hmm. It then did another series of operations later to blow up Nord Stream pipeline, switch off the gas to Germany. Now, what was the European Union? Well, it was a project from the Bank for International Settlements to subordinate through one single currency all of Europe. And so if you can get all of Europe to go onto one currency, then you can control that currency. And so they created the European Central Bank and the European Union. Now you have European Central Bank as a piggy bank to the network. And so essentially, what did they do? Well, what is Europe? Europe is big Germany. You know, Germany was the military industrial complex of the Nazi regime. That then installed a Western German central bank that then facilitated the transition to the European Central Bank via the Bank for International Settlements. And so you have Germany, which had a manufacturing base. It requires cheap gas and in order to facilitate that. And that was really the backbone of Europe. Everything else went into, it was like big Germany, you know. And that was really important for holding up Europe. So if BlackRock comes along and says, let's radicalize the world. And by the way, when I say things like this, I don't mean it's not true. Like, I don't know what your opinion is on climate change, but you can radicalize people if it's true or if it's not. You can either have a covert operation to push research out into the universities and then indoctrinate through, you know, publishing different papers. Or it could be true and you utilize it and weaponize it, and both happen. So climate change radicalized people into getting $1 trillion of European Central Bank and Bank of England money, switching off nuclear energy, losing access to the gas through sanctions, and at the same time getting them to invest trillions into renewable energy projects that were only ever going to succeed in China. You know, but BlackRock got all of that money in their portfolio companies. And so through the war, through agitating a war in Ukraine with Russia, and implementing sanctions from Europe and America, the proof of weapons network subordinated and destroyed Europe. And now the private equity companies are buying it all up on the cheap. You know, they're getting all their rare earth deals via Trump. They're getting a NATO narrative of, hey, why don't you take 5% of your budget and put it into US stocks, which is, you know, the military industrial complex. We'll install Keir Starmer, Macron, Merz, Carney in Canada. You know, these are all the chosen leaders of the proof of weapons network. And all, you know, and all Keir Starmer's job is to do is you become a battering ram for the public, but create narrative of why you can send all this money to Ukraine and then it comes back into purchasing weapons, and there's a bunch of deep state, you know, corrupt operations in the middle that siphon off much of the money. But the West just becomes a narrative for justifying what's actually happening. And the reality is, when I look at Ukraine right now, you know, Russia went from a 22% debt to GDP to a 9% debt to GDP in this time. The narrative is that they're about to, the economy is about to collapse. They're propped up by the relationship with China, and they've created, you know, this BRICS corridor that you can't defeat. And so really, Ukraine's over, sadly. And this proof of weapons network via the deep state and the military industrial complex installed Zelensky, and Zelensky is sacrificing to the last Ukrainian. Ukraine's over. Like, Russia's going to own it. There's no way out of that. And BlackRock is using the UK economy to collateralize the debt via the IMF to push Bank of England, ECB, and Fed money into the network to prop up the price of those stocks. And they're essentially getting the assets. The whole of Ukraine is going to be owned by Russia and BlackRock. That's the end result. And so when you, when Europe sanctions Russia, when America sanctions Russia, they're sanctioning Europe, because Europe is the vassal state. And they're even, I believe, manufacturing civil unrest with immigration policy, using racial tensions, religious tensions, in order to, you know, usher in a surveillance state, a central bank digital currency, a digital ID. They know that when you do this, you're going to create civil unrest. When you have civil unrest, you have what they had at Patriot Act after 9/11. You have the ability to implement what they want to implement, which is control the West fully through the technical industrial complex. And it's a very successful operation.
Successful in the short term. So my prime framing in life, I put together energy in the economy. And really, we like to think of energy as a subset of the economy, but it's exactly backwards. If you have energy, all things are possible and all things flow from that. So isn't this kind of like the children's story, killing the goose that laid the golden egg? So they're torpedoing Germany, the industrial heart of Europe. They're losing all of their energy intensive industries because, you know, they blew up the Nord Stream pipelines and they took down their last nuclear power plants, and they put this horribly expensive and intermittent alternative energy in its place. So they're deindustrializing very rapidly. I get it. So, but is private equity, what are they going to swoop in and clean up? They're basically going to, in order to gain 10% of the country's former output, they're willing to sacrifice the other 90%. I don't get it. It's like, it looks like it's a self-immolation project right now.
That would make sense if you thought America was national and Europe was national and sovereign and UK was national and sovereign. They're owned by the proof of weapons network. And so the financial industrial complex is looking at a spreadsheet and saying, right, we've asset stripped everything we can get out of here. They're so mentally drug addicted, homeless, wealth inequality. They're not having children anymore. Like, where's the labor? Who's still having labor right now? The Africans and the Middle East Muslim countries. So they're saying, right, they're the only ones that are still having labor. You know, what are we going to do with the West? Well, we need to replace all the labor with robotics and AI. We need to vassalize everything so that we can build all these data centers. And we need to engineer a reset of the world order in the Middle East. So how do we do that? Well, historically, Israel has been part of the military industrial complex. I don't think Netanyahu works for Israel. Netanyahu works for the military industrial complex. His job was to prop up the petrodollar, make sure that the Middle East never unified around their energy. And Israel was a mechanism for using religious tensions to weaponize the Jewish faith to recruit a radicalized army that believed that they were being killed by Muslims. They also used a series of operations like Iraq War, 9/11, all the Forever Wars, all the plan of the seven countries that they already decided they were going to invade pre-9/11 in order to radicalize militia groups, create groups like ISIS, Al-Qaeda. And these are just paid militia. They're not people that are trying to implement Islam around the world. That's narrative. These are armies that are agents of chaos, open to the highest bidder and contractors to intelligence. Okay. And then what did they do? They radicalized evangelical Christians into believing, and this is a narrative that's being disrupted right now, into believing you need to protect Israel. So you weaponized Christianity, Islam, and Judaism in order to make sure that the Middle East would never reunify around that early Egyptian vision of an Arab League unified around their resources. But now you want to work with the Middle East. So now you say, right, the military-industrial complex will exit the forever war model. But what are you going to give us? That's where the financial-industrial complex comes in. And they said, right, well, in order to work with Saudi Arabia, Qatar, UAE, the Gulf States, the Gulf Cooperation Council, let's stop this narrative of Iran versus Israel. Let's get, you know, China normalized between Iran and Saudi and said, let's de-dollarize. So China came along, created the construct for peace in the Middle East. And then now you've just got Israel, which historically has been propped up by military budgets. And you say, right, Israel, you're going to become a normal state now. And we would like to invest in stability and regional stability. So let's vassalize the entire Levant, Lebanon, have a Palestinian state. Saudi bought the European leaders. So you got the recognition of Palestine in Europe because Saudi spent $3 trillion to invest in all of the buying of Europe with the financial industrial complex. And so now if you look at every single deal that's happening in the world, all of them, you'll see them come out today. You've got the financial industrial complex and the GCC in every deal. Whether it's the acquisition of X, whether it's the acquisition of OpenAI, whether it's investment in NVIDIA, it is large financial players co-investing with the Gulf countries. And so they are saying, we now want to invest in building data centers and AI in the Middle East. We want you to have a nuclear program. So let's just take away the nuclear weapon narrative, which was a narrative. Let's take away strategic tension between Iran and Israel that never fight, but continually look like they're going to fight. Let's stop funding the militia groups. Let's de-radicalize. Let's tell the world, like, and you're getting all of these different people that are coming out, like Tucker Carlson, Candace Owen, and even the extremists like Nick Fuentes that were canceled before. You have these people that are now pushing narrative of, it wasn't us. We were blackmailed by Jeffrey Epstein. We never did this. It's Israel that did this. It's because Netanyahu rules the world. The Zionists rule the world. And we're the ethical Americans that got fooled by these radicals. And they're even pushing out. You know, I believe the algorithms are allowing for Jew hatred and Muslim hatred in order to, you know, push out these almost Nazi-like narratives. And this is, I think, it serves two purposes: a destabilization campaign in the West and a regional stability campaign in the Middle East. And so now I believe you're going to get the fastest growth in the Middle East because for the first time, you've got Gulf and Iran, who are the most important customer, China. And so BRICS aligned with Russia, Iran, they've got this alternative payment network. They partnered with the Gulf countries to de-dollarize, and the price of gold's going through the roof, and world reserve currency in dollars and treasuries is going down. You've got the dollar weakening. You've got the long-term rates of bonds going up. And you've got Trump saying, let's use fiscal dominance, forget the Fed, let's install some puppets, let's get those rates down to 0.25%. which is another way of saying, let's pump the hell out of the stock market and let's refinance the American debt at subsidized below market rates. How do we do that? Let's create stable coins. Let's deregulate pensions. Let's dump it on the American people because Japan's selling. The UK, we can just make them buy it. They're our largest buyer. But who's the largest buyer of foreign buyer of government, a government, US government treasuries right now? It's Cayman Island. Who's Cayman Islands?
Yeah.
Who's Cayman? It's the hedge funds. It's the financial industrial complex. So they're dumping subsidized US debt. And then you get things like 50-year mortgages, which is a bailout for the banks. That's the banks are sat on trillions of dollars of 2-3% mortgages that they'd like everyone to refinance to 6-8%. We'll do that through the 50-year. So all policies are, let's give them $2,000 checks, stimulate, let's do extended mortgages, let's launch stable coins backed by treasuries, let's allow more product into treasuries, let's push the rates down below market rate. That is subsidizing stock market growth, pumping the market while co-investing in the new world order and shrinking America into a regional power. And then telling the world, how do we tell the world, don't work with America, don't work with China now? That's tariffs is one way of doing it. And the other way is saying, we're going to kill all the Christians. The Christians are being targeted in Nigeria. Nigeria is going to say, hold on, is America going to raid us right now? We better start working with China. We better start working with Russia. We better start putting our alternative defense contracts. And then even with Israel, they're saying, all right, Israel is no longer needed. What's happening? Qatar is now doing an agreement with America, and they're all circumventing, and the Gulf countries are all doing deals without the need for the agitation, the military-industrial complex. So I think it's very, very clear. And what is China? China is the access to rare earth minerals. The trade war could never have been won. You need those rare earth minerals. Those rare earth minerals are part of military, AI, robotics, everything, the big seven. And what is Africa? Africa is China's territory now, it's the Gulf countries. So we have really transitioned to a multipolar world. And Saudi went from 100% petrodollar to 70% petrodollar and 30% petroyuan. And now China's got, they don't have their own oil and gas, but they bought the largest reserves. And so they can control energy prices as well, even though they don't produce them. So you're quite right. Wherever energy goes, the economy flows.
Mm-hmm. It's the spice in the story. So if I could paraphrase, though, it kind of sounds like this network has like locusts coming in as a plague. It's kind of asset stripped everything it kind of can out of the U.S. and the West generally, which I'll include Europe in that. So there's not a lot of squeeze left here, for not a lot of juice left in the squeeze, right? What are you going to do? Make Ford trucks $200,000? Make us pay $30,000 a month for, health insurance or whatever the story? There's not a lot left that's kind of squeezed out. Problem: you can't just put your McKinsey consultants and bankers into China. They get spotted pretty quickly. China has no need for that stuff. But they are the value-add manufacturing center, and the Middle East is the last great source of cheap energy that can be exported to the world. That feels like a match made in heaven, but you can't. Sounds like what you're saying is this network is trying to figure out how it sort of moves its locus to this next layer over here without losing control along the way. Is that true? And B, what does losing control actually look like to somebody living in the West?
Yeah, sure. So I'll take the first question. So there's no competitor to America in the proof of weapons network as a sovereign state. You have the proof of weapons network across the financial industrial complex is managing about $30 trillion of assets. The Gulf countries collectively are managing $5 trillion of assets. Mm-hmm. And then you've got China. China PPP is, it already is won the trade war. That's a done deal. But the the nobody competes with, you know, America is still very strong. It's a regional power, you know, it's got a lot for it. But its influence cannot exert influence beyond the region now. You know, it can, you can capture Latin and South America, hence the Venezuela stuff. You know, you figure out, is that China's, is that ours? And you got a few little battles. So there was a Pakistan and India, a little tuffle. You know, Pakistan is essentially historically a vassal for US and IMF. But now China comes along with Belt and Road, and Pakistan sat in the middle. Are you China or are you America? Is kind of that battle. And so the proof of weapons network is saying, right, where's our weak points? Who can we target to vassalize and infiltrate the regional powers? Firstly, the reason this is happening is because the American or proof of weapons network strategy or the military was always divide and conquer. That was always the strat. Domination through no competition. That was always the strategy. Now, what the world has figured out is they said, right, well, you know, alone and divided, we're pretty shit. But unified as a regional block, we're powerful. And so you had BRICS, you had GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council, you had ASEAN, which is the Southeast Asian and Asian exporters driven countries. And then you had the SCO, which is the Shanghai Corporation organization. And so they organized into blocks and they started strategically deciding where is our strength. So in the Gulf countries, they said, Turkey, Egypt, you've got strong military, but you're subordinate to NATO and IMF in case of Egypt. But together as the Gulf countries, we can all partner with China and BRICS. And so BRICS partnered with GCC, the SCO partnered with ASEAN, and these regional blocks became a real competing power with 75% of the world's GDP. And so I think the proof of weapons network said, what's the weak points in each one? And so they looked at BRICS and said, India. India has a neoliberal, they're a rising power. They have a population that can compete with China. We have a great, you know, we have, you know, many immigrants that are through, you know, pushing money back into the country. And they said, we can use a neoliberal strategy. So let's agitate, you know, let's agitate some covert operations between Pakistan and India and see how vassalized we can get them. You know, see how much deals we can get done. And then they said, what about the GCC? Well, let's go for UAE. They seem to be the most Western aligned. And so recently you saw a big media blitz on Sudan. You know, that's because that's a GCC territorial battle. Saudi and Egypt are back in one side, UAE's back in the other. So why don't we put some media attention on UAE's role in the humanitarian crisis in Sudan? And so you see these games where they push out media narrative in order to get deals on their terms. Now, to me, this is an acceleration of peace, but under the financial industrial complex's terms. So I believe one by one, many of the fake wars that were backed by Western imperial interest or Russian and different interests and China interests, they're being resolved one by one, but you're getting pushes of media narrative. To me, that's a good sign. But what they're doing is the financial industrial complex is trying to use the media in order to get the best terms on their terms, because they know that once you lock in regional peace, there's lots of money in the rebuild. There's lots of money in rebuilding all the war zones. But they don't have control over China, which is BRICS. They don't have control over Saudi, which is GCC. They don't have control over, you know, Singapore and various other things. We got some control, but they're sovereign wealth. They've got sovereign wealth. And they don't have a Western central bank, so we can't financialize and securitize and acquire. And so you got sovereign countries that don't have Western central banks, have built sovereign wealth, they're negotiating with the financial industrial complex. And so they're saying, what could we do? why don't we try and get BRICS to do a single currency and we can do what we did to Europe? Oh, they didn't fall for that. They're all trading in their own currencies. Damn, that trick didn't work. And that was Goldman Sachs' idea to do a single currency through BRICS. what can we do? Well, you know, we have to accept that the only thing we can do is get everyone trading in their own currencies, and then we'll start creating index funds in alternative currencies. We'll start creating a Bitcoin ETF. We'll start creating alternative gold products in alternative ETFs in alternative currencies. And so what you're noticing is they're pumping the US stock market. They're managing the transition. Many of the banks started buying the Bitcoin ETF. All the central banks started buying gold. And they're hedging by pricing products in alternative currencies so that when they want to manage the real transition, the Federal Reserve just switches policy from QE when they're ready. And so that's what I think that they're doing. And again, it doesn't mean they succeed. These operations fail a lot of the time. People get knocked off the network. People don't succeed. It's not an organized cabal that rules the world. It's a decentralized network of power and wealth that also compete with each other. And sometimes, for example, I believe what we're witnessing in Israel is you've got Trump that represents the financial industrial complex, Netanyahu that represents the military industrial complex. He wants the war to continue and get America into war with Iran. But they're saying, no, 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 the goal is regional stability. And so you're getting all of these negotiations and people that are saying, right, well, I'm going to privatize everything, but make sure I don't, Netanyahu's saying, make sure I don't go to prison. And so Trump has to endorse. And then you get email leaks from the Epstein files, which is everybody stay on track. You guys are going off track. Let's leak some information if you go off track, you know, because I don't believe that Trump has control over those files. We know who's on those files because you can look at who settled JP Morgan, you know, the banksters, the industrial, the donor class. It's not the celebrities. They had a lot of politicians in there because it was a blackmail network, but it's the donor class. And so you can see the proof of weapons network pushing out, you know, these different messages of, remember, everybody, we're moving to multipolarity. Don't suddenly get patriotic. Remember what's happening here. We're moving to multipolarity. And that's what I think they're engineering.
So in that engineering sweep, that I've had this sense that there's some sort of a ticking clock, right? Things are really speeding up. And my sense is, hypothesis, that they've really needed something like AI, a system of total domination, the eye of Sauron, able to control everything, see every crevice of your life, tell you what to buy, what not to buy, when to travel 15 minutes or not. Just control freaks, right? But I feel like they know that the old system has an expiry date, and we need to get to this new system. And it's going to be a digital system, right? Which is mostly digital prisons, I think, the way they're setting it up at this point. But is that it? Like, here's my belief. I think they don't know what they don't know. I think they're very smart people. I don't believe they understand or appreciate complex systems, and that our economy, our vaulted economy, is really a very subtle set of nested complex systems where your behaviors and my behaviors feed off of each other in emergent, unpredictable ways. And you multiply that by a billion points of interactions on a daily basis, and that's the economy. I think they think they can control it. And as a scientist, you can't control complex systems. You can only nudge them and get sort of different but emergent behaviors you have to witness. I think they can lock this thing down and get what they want. What do you think of that idea?
I agree. And I think they have an exit strategy and a control strategy. And so the idea is, let's control what we can control. But the minute this shit gets out of control, I know where I'm going to be. Everyone else can deal with it. You know, so that's what I think we're witnessing right now. I do believe that across the West, the proof of weapons network is what I believe the power structure is, as best as I can understand it and articulate it. I do believe there are sovereign countries which they have to negotiate with. You can't control China. You know, you can't, you can influence through trade, but you can't, you have to negotiate. You can't vassalize. And that's a friction. And that's why you've got the two in the AI battle, because the AI battle and the Middle East has just said, we want to sit in between that and we want to provide the energy, nuclear energy, and we'd like the data centers here, please. And we just want to sit between you in a tax neutral jurisdiction between China and, you know, between BRICS and the regional West. The proof of weapons network. And they want to sit in the middle with those capital flows. And so you do things like stable coins. And if you look at the West is being split up into... So the proof of weapons network wants private or public, you know, corporate control. That's what America is. So America is the host of subordinating all the governments to corporate control. But you want the governments underneath it to be just fully controlled by the European Central Bank, the Bank of England. And so what do you do in Europe? You do a central bank digital currency. In UK, you do a central bank digital currency. That requires civil unrest in order to scare people into signing up to a digital ID. And so you have to manufacture civil unrest in those areas. In the end, we're going to do the same in America, but we're going to use a stable coin. Why a stable coin? A stable coin is a privatized version of a central bank digital currency. They don't want to hand over control to the government. They want governments to be vassals to corporates. And so everything goes up to those stable coins, and those stable coins are backed by fiscal dominance and the US debt. And so that's their strategy of vassalizing the entire West into a stable coin so that they can dump all of the US debt and the below market rate treasuries on the West. So they're the bag holders because the foreigners aren't buying them anymore. In the meantime, that takes us into a world of uncertainty because this labor force isn't productive here. We need to tell the Americans that we're rebuilding our manufacturing base. We can push down rates by saying unemployment data means that we don't care about inflation because the Fed's got the twin mandate, inflation and unemployment. We can use employment as a mechanism for getting those rates down while the data look, you know, inflation is rampant, but let's move it to structural manipulated 3% rather than 2%. You can get oil prices down to try and dampen some of that inflation, but the only other way to get a deflationary impact is artificial intelligence and robotics. So that is the manufacturing base. If you look at all the layoffs, they're saying the recent, you know, spike, 150,000 layoffs in October, 1 million over the year. That I think they said that was the biggest since 1993 or something, maybe 2003. Sorry if I got that wrong. But a long time anyway. And they said the layoffs are coming. The primary reason was firstly government, so DOGE. The government is essentially just a piggy bank for the corporate interest, but they're laying off and providing all the data to AI, of course. That's what DOGE was, I think, in my opinion. It was a data collection exercise for Palantir and Elon and the social credit score that X has become. Pushing off and siphon off all of that data. And they said the most of the automation's happening in warehousing. So that, to me, implies robotics is here. South Korea just announced that they're doing fully automated warehouses. And so robotics and AI is the thing. Now, that has vast unemployment. Where does that take us? I mean, who knows? Why don't we test a stablecoin universal basic income? I know Trump says tariffs. Everyone can have a tariff dividend. Let's see if we can give everyone $2,000. That feels like incremental steps to a privatized universal basic income. It may not pass Congress. It could just be rhetoric. You know, you don't know with Trump. But you can see where they're taking surveillance state there, resetting the world order. But I'm sadly just think the West doesn't return from this. You've got, I would say, I personally believe
The tactics that the West used via the British and American Empire on Asia, on the Middle East, on the Global South, on Africa, are being used, and they're coming home. And so the colored revolutions, the civil unrest, the overthrow, the weaponization of religious tensions, racial tensions, I see all of that, those tactics that I saw around the world coming home. And so the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. You end up on a universal basic income, or you end up with all the assets. And the way to manage this is to, in a fiscal dominance environment, I believe, is to own scarce assets and the right stocks. And so you either co-invest with BlackRock, they manage your offshore exposure, and most of the stock markets right now are outperforming the S&P. The S&P looks really strong, but it's only because it's priced in a devaluing currency. If you price it in gold, it's going down. Bitcoin's had a bit of a hard time this year, but if you price it in Bitcoin, it's, you know, it's in a bear market. Real estate stocks, well, all of them are in bear market in Bitcoin and gold if you price it over the, you know, the last decade or so. You need to own scarce assets to ride it. That's the gold story. And I think real estate will be pumped. Obviously, that's a generalized statement. Location matters. You understand, whatever. Or you own the stocks and get the exposure, you know, which is international. You got to see outside of America right now. And you're seeing that the stocks are just becoming the big 10 tech companies with some resources. And everything else is struggling, like mergers and acquisitions of the private sector. Businesses are going bankrupt. Mergers and acquisitions are rampant and through the roof. And now we've got a $5 trillion company called NVIDIA. Why is that? It's because it's the AI data center. So the stock market is no longer a function of revenue, profits, earnings per share. It's a function of geopolitically strategic importance to the proof of weapons network. They'll never let NVIDIA go because NVIDIA is going to be building these data centers and giving us its leverage. When they're negotiating with the Gulf countries, they're negotiating with NVIDIA. When they're negotiating with China, they're negotiating with semiconductor chips.
Well, that's fascinating. You know, again, let me put my resource hat on for a second. Even the EIA in the United States, which is the Energy Information Agency under the DOE, has said, look, the shale basins are about played out. They're going to start peaking now by 2027. That's it. Off they go. Right. And that's it. That's the end of the shale story. You know, not, and it doesn't run out, but I mean, it's not an engine of oil growth anymore. Similarly, we have a lot of natural gas, but we are LNG terminaling it so fast. Plus the data centers, which, by the way, nobody can give me an honest, accurate accounting at the national level of how many are actually going in. Even states don't know necessarily how many are going in. Right. It's kind of vague, right? So it's got this feeling to me like it's an existential emergency. I know him when I smell him, right? Suddenly Bill Gates is no longer about climate change. He suddenly thinks maybe it's not as important as we thought, because obviously he's going to make a lot of money off a data center. So changes his tune, that kind of guy. So, but I watched them put these data centers in with their horrific energy demands. And by the way, I think of them as giant toaster ovens that don't actually make toast, right? They take tasty molecules of natural gas and they turn it into waste heat. And that's what they do. And cute pictures of cats, right? It's fine. But I look at this and it's just such a pell-mell thing. This is the easiest thing for me to see. We're sailing right into an energy crisis. It's already hit lots of households with doubling and even triplings of energy bills, electricity bills. And that's going to continue because it's the oldest supply-demand price chart in the world. And again, Simon, I don't get the sense that if somebody has a plan, man, they are keeping it hidden really well from me.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, China has been, it's, so again, climate change narrative was more like a substitute. Okay, we're going to hit peak energy and therefore we need to replace it with renewable energy. Now I don't think it's a substitute anymore. I think it's an addition. You know, it's every type of energy, every way possible. Nuclear energy, renewable energy, LNG, oil, every energy. The demand for energy in every form goes through the roof, because this is just an energy guzzler. And I think the amount of investment, I think in there's trillions of dollars in investment that needs to be placed into all of these different forms of energy. Nothing stops this train, you know, and that's where a lot of the fiscal dominance is going to happen. I just see there's energy for everything is where mm-hmm. it goes. And how do you constrict people? Well, carbon credits, tokenize it, make people compete in the market for their energy. And so that's part of the whole stablecoin social credit score, carbon credit score, you know. Yeah. And that's the sad thing. The people don't matter in this plan. You know, the only countries that are saying, let's take our money and reinvest it in our people are the sovereign ones. It's the Gulf countries. It's the Chinese. It's the Russians. America doesn't care about the Americans. The UK doesn't care about the Brits. The Europeans don't care about, you know, the EC, the European Union doesn't care about the Europeans. These are just assets. And so everything is about data centers, water, and energy. And we're going to AI robotics, and nothing stops our train. I can't see anything that stops our train. And I think they're thinking about every form of energy in order to power this thing. And China's been buying all the oil, all the gas, all the investment in renewable energy, all the nuclear programs. And this is why Middle East needs regional stability. They're saying we can't mess around with wars anymore. We need this energy.
Absolutely. So let's talk about exit strategies then. So we hinted at it before. I had a two-part question. Part two was really like, well, what if they fumble the ball, right? And you said, well, they have their exit strategies. My exit strategy is I'm talking to you from my home studio, and right outside these walls, I got cows, I got chickens, I got a spring, I got like a little farm, right? So part of my strategy. I sit in gold, I sit in silver, I sit in hard assets. I'm clearly investing in this energy stuff that's coming forward. That's what I'm doing. But let's talk, what can people listening to this, they see all this big stuff going on. Obviously, there's elephants dancing. We're all just mice in the field. What do the mice do?
Yeah, I mean, I think it moves back. So in the case of the West, if you're in America, I believe it becomes all about community. I think what people need to do is pretend that the government's not going to look after you. Mm-hmm. There is no healthcare. There is no, you know, anything. There is no universal basic income. And start with that and say, what am I going to do to look after myself? Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing is, you know, it's interesting, right? Across America and the West, you find all these little communities of cult leaders, and they seem to create these self, neutral cults of people that all look after each other and look after the community. Why not do that without the cult? Does there need to be a cult leader? Why can't people just look after each other and bolt buy and various other things? So I think people need to get used to that if they're not wealthy already. I personally believe in the next 5 years, we're going to have 200 years of change. Just imagine, I could be wrong, but I think there's 200 years of change. I think in 5 years, we probably don't recognize what this AI experiment does. I don't know. I really don't know. But I do know that I want to own my own assets, whether that be gold, or personally, I like Bitcoin because it's easier to self-custody. It comes with a higher risk to gold. And I think people just need to, everything should be about thinking about how to be sovereign in every way possible, and build your community, build your followers, build your little communities that you bought by. Get to know, if you don't know your neighbors, now's the time to build relationships with neighbors. I don't think people should be living in cities in this transition. I think you should be thinking about, you know, the things that you've been talking about. I think the cities are going to be the hardest hit. Right now you need to be, I mean, everyone's so deep in debt that this might just be silly advice, but the obvious advice: spend less than you earn, save the difference in a hard asset, and that asset needs to outperform the proof of weapons network, and that's how you increase your wealth, because everyone else is is either going to be looked after by the government or looked after by you working with your community. So the government may look after you, but I'd be preparing for how the community look after each other. And I don't know what else to say, but I do believe that I reckon you got 5 years to figure this stuff out, because I don't know what the world looks like after 5 years. And that's what I think everyone needs to think about now. And we could be exaggerating, we could be wrong, but if you prepare for the next 5 years as if this was true, you'll be better prepared for whatever the next 10 years gives us. You know, so I think we've just hit a crunch point. And I think the world can look around and they can see, look, the worst is not looking healthy. Like, everything is looking strange. We're treating each other. It's getting more and more populist. People are talking about militias and revolutions. And revolution is part of their plan, by the way. That's how you get the surveillance state. They don't care if you have a revolution. That's okay. They figured out what they do with a revolution. You need to build your wealth. You need to build your community. And I do leave with, there is a greater power structure. This artificial intelligence may be the very same thing that messes them up as well. We don't know. But I have a spiritual belief that there is a higher power, which is God. And God has a plan, and you know, we need to figure out what that means in terms of our connection. I'm not here to preach you. It comes in all sorts of different forms, spiritual, different religions. But you know, there is a greater power, and this network is very evil. And I do believe that God has a plan for evil, and I don't think evil prevails. You know, so do with that as you would, your spiritual connection, your community connection, and build your wealth in neutral assets.
Perfectly said. I honestly couldn't have said it better myself, and I've been studying this for decades. That's right where I came to as well, and all the way down to this idea that evil has exposed itself, and once I saw it, I couldn't unsee it, and it's just there. It's a force, and history, if you get your history from the Bible, says we've been here before. This is a great pendulum of humanity. We lose the plot from time to time. And obviously a country that's allowed itself to slip to a point where one in 30 children is developing autism, when it can't protect its own children, has entirely lost the plot, right? As one indicator, right? I have many indicators, but just to say, fractally speaking, I don't need more than that one indicator to say lost the plot. And we know what happens next in that story. It's been termed wrath in the past. And sometimes that wrath is just the outcome of making really bad decisions. And sometimes it might be something more divine. I don't know. But I think it does get hard for a while. So I would echo that everybody should be thinking about becoming more resilient. And that's emotionally, spiritually, financially. You want to have skills, right? Absolutely. You want to have, obviously, assets. A lot of people, Simon, I say prepare, and they think bullets, beans, and bunkers, right? That's fine, but that's just one component. That's material wealth. There's all these other forms of wealth you really should be building up right now, but chief among those is your emotional resilience, which begins with me not allowing these stupid AI algorithms to control my emotional state and to feed me all that propaganda you've been talking about. It's really important. Keep an equal, calm head.
Yeah, I agree. The algorithm that you're being fed right now is designed to make you hate people. You know, depending on which side of the algorithm is, you either hate Muslims, you hate Jews, you hate Democrats, you hate Republicans.
White men, whatever.
You know, you're a white nationalist. It's the immigrants, it's the blacks, it's whatever. Your algorithm is feeding you the content to push your hatred. That is very, very deliberate. You got to become very conscious of that, because that is a psychological operation that is happening. And I really love that you said children, because I completely agree with that. I feel like if there's one thing that we universally agree on, that we should be protecting our children. Like, you know, whatever color or religion that child is, we inherently understand that that is an innocent to be protected, to be nurtured. And when we're using children, and there is sexual pedophilia rings, there is children being blown up in wars, There is, you know, the weaponization of children, and we're not even having children. You know, there's something wrong. I think that's a really like good way of saying, no, this doesn't last, because I think if we've lost the ability to protect and have children, then we've gone off the plot, and we need to return to that. How do we look after our children, whatever religion, race, or creed they may be? You know, we can all agree we should be protecting our innocent children. If we're not doing that, we need to figure out how to do that again.
Well, absolutely. And when we do discover that, say, people at the FDA or CDC had purposely hidden harmful trial results so that they could continue to do whatever, sell more whatever for pharma, I honestly think those people need to be held to account in the highest possible way, and we need to have real consequences. So if I was going to run for president, I'd have one plank, and everybody could try and ask me anything they want about anything, and I'd come right back to my plank, which is consequences. They're not just for little people anymore. You know, that would be the whole thing.
I agree. 'Cause again, and we're poisoning our children. We're injecting our children. Like, there's something up here. You know, we need to remind ourselves what we were brought on this earth to do, and it's not what we're currently doing.
Correct. Well, Simon, what an amazing conversation, and we could go a lot longer, but I'm going to call it there. Where can people find you and follow your work?
So I'm very active on X, so you can follow me at Simon Dixon Twit, TWITT, when it was Twitter. I go live on YouTube, just look up my name, and I have a weekly show called Bitcoin Hard Talk. It says Bitcoin because that's where I came from. But what I do is I go through following the money in Bitcoin and crypto and tech. I do This Week in Macro, and I do This Week in Geopolitics. So in order to make sure I'm staying up to date with everything that's happening every week, I have to report it to everyone on a Friday. Mm-hmm. So I do these marathon shows every Friday, mainly to keep myself up to date, you can benefit from me following the money. And then I publish everything on my blog, simondixon.com. I'm very fortunate that I've managed to exit my business. Bitcoin gave me a level of financial independence I never thought was possible. And so I'm kind of in that stage of life of where I like to give back with no sponsorship, no monetization. And I'm just trying to build a community of people that are going to be able to look after each other a bit better.
Oh, that's absolutely wonderful. And it's very clear, it's obvious that you have no financial conflicts of interest. You're willing to say what sounds to me like the truth, right? Which is just, here are the facts, here's how the pattern fits, and you don't have to worry about sponsors yelling at you. So that sort of comes through loud and clear. So thank you so much for doing that. Thank you for your time today, and I wish you all the best, and let's stay in contact.
Yeah, absolutely. Chris, I really enjoyed the conversation. Really appreciate your work. I think you're doing a very valuable thing and educating people on how to navigate this. I think is what we should be doing. So I'd love to come back at any time, and appreciate you having me. Thank you, Chris.